Excellent, cool. So what I want to do now is to try to think about secularisation, as in to not speculate, but to try to drill down into what we do know and how we can best understand the kind of phenomenon that we're all kind of articulating as we experience life and ministry in this world and in our particular context. Because like I say, all those premises I started with are all contestable. They might not be right. Maybe there isn't secularisation happening. Maybe there's a change, but secularisation is the wrong word. Or maybe the change is a change that doesn't require any change on our part. And I think there's lots of little factoids running around in our heads and in the atmosphere. And then there is a big narrative that is in lots of people's heads that is not evidence-based, that turns out not to be true, at least not to be true. Ironically, especially the narrative taken by the new atheists, I think shipwrecks massively against actual evidence. So that's where I want to go with this session, to think about secularisation and to get the best kind of understanding we can. And there are two... We're thinking about like kind of factoids, like things that aren't true or kind of myths about secularisation. There's two very common sources of exaggerating the rate and nature and impact of secularisation, and they come from two sources: Australian secular historians. So your history, the history of your country and my country, we are very poorly serviced by our historians when it comes to the history of Christianity in Australia. So to a kind of almost ludicrous degree, I think the narrative told in the mainstream of Australian history radically undersells the role and significance of Christianity in our founding, in our 19th century, in our 20th century, in the rates of church attendance, the impact of Christian ideas and Christian communities and Christian stuff, hugely underestimated by a very secularist historiography. So I think that world underestimates or overestimates how secular we are, and Christian leaders have a habit of overestimating how secular we are and how secularised we've become. So Stuart Piggin, the Australian historian, and Bruett Taylor, who is in UK, and Hugh Chilton, also in Australia, have all written articles, and in one case a whole thesis, showing that Christian leaders tend to exaggerate the rates of secularisation and the desperateness of the scene, and often do that in anticipation rather than in the wake of actual secularisation. And I call this the Baptist and bootleggers problem. So, you know, in Prohibition, who are the two people that really wanted Prohibition? Baptists, they didn't want you drinking, and bootleggers, because they really wanted to make money out of you drinking. And so two people for exactly the opposite reasons wanted Prohibition, and I think here two people for exactly the opposite reasons have kind of exaggerated the rate of secularisation. So I give you that as a warning. So let's get some definitions on the table. Firstly, what is secularisation? So the word secular, it's probably known to many people here, the word secular is a word that actually comes out of Christian theology. So in the medieval era, and to this day in the Roman Catholic Church, you have secular priests and religious priests, or secular orders and religious orders. And the secular orders in the Roman Catholic Church aren't those orders that don't believe in God. They're the orders that are... Does anyone know? They do stuff in the world. Yeah. Yeah, as opposed to contemplative. So you can have an order that's entirely contemplative, and you go to a monastery and you just pray for the church, and everything you do is religious. Or you have a secular order that goes and helps the poor and teaches in schools and does that kind of thing. And a secular, because the word secular, coming from of this world, of this temporal world, in that sense it is came out of medieval way of thought. And even within the, until very recently, was still essentially a Christian concept, as opposed to, I don't think Hinduism would ever give you the word secular. Because Christian theology does, because of the doctrine of the Creator God, does create the space for the secular world, that is the temporal world, this world, to be of value and worth poking and prodding and understanding. And so, in Catholic thinking, secular is not prejudicial. You don't think, oh, the secular orders are bad orders because they care for the poor, and the religious orders are good orders because they pray. They both have their own integrity, and because God is creator and redeemer, and so it's worth being involved in this world as it's worth contemplating the world to come. And even into recent history in Christian, in Australian thinking, so the debate in Australian history over secular education, that education should be secular, what that originally meant was education should be non-sectarian. So secular and let's not have Protestant schools and Catholic schools. So secular was the opposite of the Northern Irish system, where you had state Catholic and state Protestant schools. Having secular education meant let's have a system where you do maths and it's not Catholic maths or Protestant maths. It's just maths. Not because there's no God in maths, but because God the Creator created a world in which maths makes sense, and that is a place to study under the Creator God this world, and it's not an appropriate place for sectarian debates. And so, you know, it was very common for Protestant Christians and Protestant leaders to want to have a secular education system, by which they did not mean a secularist education system or a God for his own, but on the contrary, a place where people could come together. Also, it makes sense of why you have the Lord's Prayer. Has that been got rid of yet? The Lord's Prayer in Parliament? Still there?
Still there.
Still there, okay. Which is this is weird. Having the Lord's Prayer is a secular matter because both Protestants and Catholics could pray it. So the Lord's Prayer didn't destroy principles of a secular parliament because it wasn't Hail Mary, Mother of God, the Lord is with thee. It didn't divide the thing. It was a common prayer. Whether last or not. So, okay, secular in that kind of Christian theological sense, its original meaning of this world, not Catholic or Protestant, God the Creator. Then modernity moves from secular being not just a place where this world could be studied under God and for the glory of God, but a religious free zone. So a place where God was not just it wasn't just God the Creator, but God became kind of irrelevant to that space, that area became secular, as in an allegedly non-religious space. So James Smith says it's the notion of the secular, that it's this notion of the secular that is assumed both by secularisation thesis and by normative secularism. So for example, when people are saying, oh, we want a more secular culture, they don't mean we want less Protestant Catholic debates, or we want to study the creation under God and for God and value this order. They mean it in the second sense now, a God-free zone, thus pushing God and religious discourse into the private spheres, to say that we here's this space where God is not welcome and God language is not okay, and here are these increasingly smaller spaces where you can talk about God, and then God retreats to that private world of church and family rather than to the public world of space. And so Charles Taylor, again the French Canadian philosopher, talks about this and about the way you have a secular state in the sense that the state has no opinion, therefore everything's welcome. So the state won't arbitrate between Protestant, Catholic, or between those things, and so you can bring your language in, versus the more aggressive kind of secular state, maybe like France, I don't know if that's true, Owen, where you'd say this is we're not just saying the state doesn't arbitrate, but the state arbitrates in favour of keeping religious discourse out of the state and society. And then finally, philosophical. So historically, a Christian term, in modernity it becomes a phenomenon of less God, more neutral or apparently neutral, and then philosophically secularism is that mental world in which belief in God is only one option amongst many. Or again, Charles Taylor says, a move from a society where belief in God is unchallenged and indeed unproblematic to one in which it is understood to be one option amongst many and frequently not the easiest option. A mental world where belief in God takes effort, as opposed to a world where everything conspires toward you believing in God. And it's a philosophical approach to life, secularism, which pitches itself to the world, secularism, as our world minus religion. So I think the way secularism presents itself to the world is to say, hey, we're just going to give you your world and we'll vacuum up the crazy and this is what's left. A subtraction story about what getting rid of the crazy. So you can have, if you think about a secular state, you can have a secular state and a religious society, or a religious state and a secular society. So not all forms of secularism exist to the same extent in the same place at the same time. Can anyone think of a place that you would describe as secular in the state and religious in the society? China would be a secular, so the state is avowedly secular, indeed atheist, and the culture is, you're saying, is...
Well, I mean, everyone says that Christianity is growing in China.
Yeah, right. Yeah, sure, okay. Yep.
Dubai?
What is Dubai? It's a...
massive capitalism.
Yes. Yeah, a religious community with a kind of capitalistic world or ethos or whatever. Yeah. I reckon one of the weird differences between the United States and Australia is that the United States is way more secular in the state. So the Lord's Prayer in the Senate is unthinkable, but a much more religious culture than Australia. Where here we've got the Lord's Prayer in the Parliament, and a very irreligious culture. India, most religious nation on earth, but with an ostensibly secular government. Or I think the opposite would be somewhere like Denmark or the United Kingdom, which is not technically a religious state, state church, spiritual lords in the House of Lords. An anthropologist could not look at that society and say, is God excluded from the state? In all sorts of ways, no, the Queen's the head of the Church of England and so on, but a wildly more secular situation than America, which has got a technically secular state. So those things need to be kind of parsed out. Secularisation thesis is the thesis, the belief that as cultures experience modernisation, religious belief declines. So this is the secularisation thesis. It is a old thesis that says that as modernism goes up, religious belief goes down. A basic rule of society, the more modern, the less religious. And by modern they mean industrialised, urbanised, mass education. Normally, a nation state and so on. So that's the secularisation thesis, which we'll come back to. You can think about secularisation happening at these three levels. So societal secularisation, the society is less religious. Organisational secularisation, that the religious organisations decline. And personal secularisation, that individuals become less religious. So societal, organisational, and personal, and like I was saying before, you can imagine situations where they aren't all equally dialed up or down at the same way. Like religious, you can have people who don't believe but do participate in religion, people who do believe but don't participate in religion, states that are religious with societies that aren't, or vice versa. And then finally, secularism, which we mentioned, is that a belief that the world, a worldview that the world, that life can be lived without reference to transcendence, and says that that's intellectually plausible and passively and practically livable. And then secularization, that can be like a thing, I am secular, or it can be a more programmatic thing, a belief that society should be actively secularized. That we should, if you think about secularization as a balloon, let's just keep blowing that balloon up and up and up so it occupies more and more space and push religious things further and further to the corner. As a belief, Charles Taylor again talks about exclusive humanism, and he says that this is, and this is where we start to get to our situation. So Charles Taylor, the great Catholic philosopher, says that exclusive humanism, that is that a belief that life can and ought to be lived without any reference beyond itself beside human flourishing, Taylor says that is a new thing in the world. So if you go backwards in history, it's a 900-page book, maybe he missed something, but he says that's new, that's not been true for Roman religion, for Greek religion, for religion in the subcontinent. It's not true of communism or the Soviet Union. The idea that without any reference to transcendence, broadly understood as a good beyond my good, a good that's greater than my good, the idea that you can live your life exclusively in the imminent frame, that there's no such thing as a thing for which it might be worth sacrificing, or that you could ever make a decision that here is a thing that would be comfortable for me, but because of a good that's bigger than me, I will not take that comfort. He calls that exclusive humanism, and he says that's new. Like, no one has ever tried to evangelize that person before. That person didn't exist before, as far as we know. He says, this is Taylor, and I quote, "For the first time in human history, a purely self-sufficient humanism came to be a widely available option." So he's not excluding the idea that maybe Voltaire thought like that or something, but he says, "For the first time in human history, a purely self-sufficient humanism came to be a widely available option. I mean by this humanism accepting no final goal beyond human flourishing, nor any allegiance to anything else beyond this flourishing. Of no previous society was this true." So because of that, I think we've got a topic. Like, I think there's, in terms of my three theses, I think, or my three premises, I think there's something to talk about here, that there is a new thing in the world. There have been new things before, like one time there was no such thing as Buddhism, no such thing as communism, but there is this thing called humanism, and it is a widely available option to live your life without any reference to transcendence beyond yourself. Any questions about that yet?
Could you just clarify, you're saying that communism doesn't fit that because communism... See, I would read that and say communism fits square to that, but you're saying no, because communism is about, somewhere, it's about human flourishing. And no aim about that. But you're one of the ones.
Yeah, so I would think that I would class communism, especially kind of if you think of Soviet communism, as technically a kind of religion or having a kind of transcendence in it, in that communism did require huge sacrifice. That an individual could decide that they would give their life, or sadly, most of those lives were decided to be given by another.
But wasn't the aim for human flourishing? So it's just a different, like the overall aim is still giving a life for the flourishing of humanity.
Yes,
and
yeah.
Yes.
So Taylor would say that, of course, Buddhism and Christianity and Islam are all about human flourishing. So each one of those is saying, this is how humans flourish. But within that system, they'll say, Christianity will say, take up your cross and follow me. Prosaically, not without difficulty, but don't sleep with that person, or don't, in martyrdom, don't defend your life. Now, that doesn't say that, or the Buddha says that, desire, all life is suffering, suffering comes from desire, you know, whatever. There'll be inbuilt sacrifices toward a broader thing of human flourishing that might not, in that instance, include your human flourishing. And so I think in that sense, communism fits for the individual, and Taylor is trying to tease out a new thing, he thinks it's a new thing, of exclusive humanism, where once you've answered the question of my personal flourishing, you've exhausted the conversation.
It's the individual flourishing rather than the society.
That's right. That's a really helpful definition. That's right. So once you've decided on your own personal flourishing, you've exhausted the... Yes.
Is this connected to what Jonathan was saying earlier about we don't need to survive anymore because of the engine and life or so? So like we're more comfortable than we live for happiness.
Yeah, so we'll come back to that. I think technology aids and abets exclusive humanism. Like it's hard to imagine without it, so I'd say it's a necessary but not sufficient cause. Put it like that. Yeah. So that's right. Okay. Now, thinking about countries in Australia. Australia is obviously a secular society in the sense that there are vast ways of life that are non-religious. That you, as you, you know, shop or work with the state or whatever. It's excluded. The Lord's Prayer is an interesting case study in a kind of secularism that, you know, of a historic nature. The United States is an interesting contrast in being far more radical in its separation of church and state than Australia, but far less secular than Australia in terms of organisations and so on. So a much more religious culture with a much more secular public discourse. It's kind of an odd thing. And so my question then is Australia secularising? Because you could say maybe it's not, massive, secularisation on any or all of these fronts. Society, that is the parliament, the schools, the public spaces, are they increasingly secular, religious-free and God-free zones? Organisationally, are churches, parachurches, religious movements going up or down? And then personally, are rates of behaviour and belief for individuals going up or down? And what's your guess? Yes?
Yeah, I think there's actually an openness from grassroots for expansion, like in the religious, but it's almost like there's not the uptake available. You know, people aren't joining any communities now, so opportunities there are grassroots, but connecting and joining and support, there seems to be a low sort of base of numbers getting into that.
Interesting. Okay, so you were talking about in terms of your conversations at the school gate and stuff, that there's a like, oh, I'm open, but it's not translating into membership and activity. Yeah, okay, yeah, good observation. Yeah. I think my understanding of the data is that empirically, all three are trending south in terms of, so personal rates of belief and behaviour, less than they were 10 years ago, churches and organisations less than they were 10 years ago, and I think a kind of broadly understood in the last 10 years move of a kind of more aggressively secular state and obvious space. So I think our moment is a secular moment. So I've got a quote here from Gandalf, I think. We don't get to choose our times, all we have to do is decide what to do with the time that was given us. I think it's just worth pausing for a moment and saying that this is our moment, that we didn't get paganism or high, corrupt Roman Catholicism. That's not our moment. We got secularism. And because it's the kind of, we're fish and this is water and it feels normal, it's just worth saying that that's not normal. That a world of, a belief in exclusive humanism, of secularism, is a contingent moment that we're in. And I think, like missionaries, you know what I mean? If a missionary goes to Morocco and they spend a bit of time researching Islam, you think, great, I kind of want you to do that if you're going to be reaching Muslims. And I think it turns out we're in a secular context, and that's our moment. And so if you wish you're in another moment, sorry. Yes?
I'm not sure if you sort of deal with this later on, but the earth is going to be south. Someone mentioned just recently, society and even politics, if you're still talking about at least one religion, which is Islam, there's still this conversation there. So has civilization somehow linked itself with Islam being the minority, persecuted, whatever? It seems like a very strange mix.
Yes. The prominence of the discussion of Islam, and so you couldn't say, oh, if you, yeah, so if you did a, like a quantitative survey of mentioning of religion in the last 20 years, maybe there's more mention of religion than in the years before 9/11, for example. Yes, yeah. And maybe there was a gap there that we, a lot of us lived through, where religion was less on the table because we were post-sectarian. So if you go back to the 50s and 60s, there's all sorts of discussion about Protestants and Catholics. Now there's all sorts of discussion about Islam. And in the middle, maybe we lived through a moment where there kind of, maybe there was an increase. So almost everything's going south, not everything, but I'm gonna give you the data. So firstly, it's real. This is not a drill. This is actually happening. The feeling that you feel, if you feel like this, is not made up. So, in 1901, Federation, 95% of Australians claimed a Christian religious affiliation, and a majority participated in church at more than Christmas and Easter. The percentage of Christians in the Australian 2016 census was 52.1%, down from 61.1% in 2011. I think it's worth noticing that, because that's very memorable. That's our time, right? That's not, I remember 2011. I probably had the same playlist. Like, it's not, do you know what I mean? That's not me remembering me wearing flares or being into Blink 182 or whatever. That's the same me. And 10%, which is translated actually to a fall of 94, that many. Is that up there? 949,161 Christians. A fall, despite a big increase in Australia's population. And that decrease is almost entirely the result of Christians becoming no religion. Right? So it's not the result of the war generation or the great generation dying. Between 2011 and now, most of those nearly, 1 million, you know, 900,000 people changed. They deconverted. They might not get up in, you know, and give a deconversion testimony at the local atheist club or whatever. But people who once put down Christian now put down none, or exclusive humanist, as we'll eventually get it to change in the census. So the Christians fell away in all age groups from baby boomers onwards, though heaviest around those in their 20s. Young groups least likely to be Christian are Greens, and Labor voters, de facto couples, shared households, and men. And Christianity is still popular, relatively popular among females, conservatives, the very wealthy, and those living in remote areas. So less than 15% go to church regularly, less than 7% are actively involved. And as best we can see, that decline is continuing. Here's a summary statement from a demographer. In summary, it can be seen that there's many issues facing the church. The fact that these issues are centred around young people is of a special concern. There appears to be one group in particular that's been overlooked, which is the young, who tend to be more liberal-minded and lean left, and churches must find ways to engage this group. This group looks very similar to the people who nearly elected Bernie Sanders or Jeremy Corbyn, and this generation is at the forefront of that kind of decline. So the trend is not toward the New Age. The trend in terms of conversion is not toward Islam. Demographically, there's some growth there, but not by conversion. Or any other secular, any other religion, it's towards secular. So that's the movement, which I know it sounds so intuitive, it sounds obviously right, but it's just worth saying that actually it turns out to be true, not false, that people overwhelmingly are saying none. I go from Christian to none, not Christian to New Age or Christian to Islam or another religion. Ours is a secular age. So it's real, I think, on any available front, it's actually happening. But then I do secondly want to say it is complicated. So I do think that the change is beyond dispute and that the change is towards secularisation. But there's a few little quirky things that are worth noticing. So church attendance, down. Personal belief, down. But religion in politics went up under the Howard and Rudd governments. So you just don't know what to do with that, but for some reason you had this period where Hansard had more references to God and churches and stuff, and where suddenly, for some reason in that moment, there was a lot of God speech in the parliament and among politicians. No idea what to do with that, but it's just an empirical thing that needs to be put in there. And religious schools. So at least church schools, you might be cynical or not about how whatever they are, but for some reason, those schools run by churches have gone up, and it's just worth factoring that in. Not quite sure what to do with all that. The huge elephant in the room, and the counterfactual, and it's ridiculous once you say this out loud, but secularisation is not true of most people, most places now. So the global south, this conversation makes kind of no sense. In fact, we live through, so weird to say, but we're living through the greatest ever expansion of Christianity in human history ever. Which is just such a weird thing to say. But it's true, so Latin America, and Asia and Africa. And so what do you do with that? The global south is booming religiously in all sorts of great and in all sorts of not so great ways. And you have other weird things. So, for example, like, do you know what the most religious city in the United Kingdom is? So, it's London, which, again, is kind of weird. There's this kind of narrative about Christianity doesn't work in cities and it's been whatever, but London is, you know, the most religious city in England and the most Christian city in England. And it's not just because of the churches that you might visit. So you might go to, I don't know, All Souls or St. Helens or somewhere there. But those statistics are enormously shaped by huge Afro-Caribbean congregations. And so the kind of the people that maybe we are more familiar with and the streams that we're more familiar with in London, flourishing though they are not the things that are affecting the statistics in London. They are being affected by the global south having their presence in London. And so it's very worth just pausing and remembering I'm living through the greatest ever expansion of Christianity ever. And rejoicing in that, because it's a great thing. Thirdly, in the complications, it's not linear. So this is the big point, maybe the big take home from today. It's not the case, if you look at that 1901 to 2017 in Australia, it's not the case that it's just been gently easing off, that the graph goes down in a linear fashion. It hasn't been going like that since 1788 or the 1850s or 1901. Indeed, the change from 1901 to 1960 was like barely perceptible, and in some cases went in the other direction. So after the war, after World War II, from the early 1950s to 1963, we lived through a minor religious boom in Australia. So the indices started to go up. At Bible college enrolments were huge. Theological college enrolments were huge. Most churches had their biggest ever intake of ordinands. The Sunday school movement was flourishing. The 1950s, the trend went the other way, and I think that the 1959 Billy Graham Crusade, which is often understood as a catalyst, I think it was a result rather than a cause. So I think the 1959 Billy Graham Crusade came at the end of a religious boom rather than precipitating a religious boom. And so it was kind of like the crowning achievement of a very productive decade rather than the thing, because in a really sort of weird way, 1959, Billy Graham, everything's trending upwards, and then from 1963, things start to head down in really kind of radical ways, and to a really weird extent, 1963 is the date, like as opposed to 1962 or 1964. It's this kind of moment in Australia, and Callum Brown talks about it as well in the UK, where there is a precipitous decline in Christian everything, belief, behaviour, belonging, in 1963. I was talking about this in Sydney a few months ago at a conference there, and Paul Harrington, who works at Holy Trinity Church in Adelaide, heard me present on this, and then he presented on their church later, just how they do church planting, church growth and stuff like that. And he set up, he showed the graph, and sure enough, there's Holy Trinity trending up across the 50s to 1963, and then suddenly starts going down. And so at their church, there's this kind of sense of a golden age in the 50s that's normally credited to the minister, who I'm sure was a wonderful man, but it turns out almost anyone could get things to trend up in the 1950s. And so I think it's worth that if you're kind of thinking, whatever that guy did, actually whatever anyone did, like it just was a global trend. So again, the kind of civic video in Albany scenario, you don't want to overread your situation, because there was something about that moment that went up, and then something about 1963 that everything starts to come down. And I think that's where I kind of like been my big learning in studying this stuff, because it's just worth, I don't think that's the narrative that most of us or most of the people on the bus have about what happened to Christianity in the West. So I think most people have a intuitive, unresearched, gentle decline, enlightenment, origin of species, 60s relevant, but just kind of this thing. And that's not empirically the case. So it's not actually the case that Christianity has just been, it's like in a prize-fighting ring with science and rationalism, and it just took blow after blow and eventually just kind of collapsed. You've actually got this very steep, sharp collapse at a kind of specific point, and over that era, a whole lot of stuff. So you think about some of the stories that we have in our heads. So I think if you read The New Atheist or lots of secular accounts, they basically say you have the rise of the scientific method in the 1600s, you have the Enlightenment in the 1700s, you have Darwin's Origin of Species in 1857, and then you have like the 60s, and that's how it goes, and we're reeling from having a supernatural worldview, and now science is winning or whatever. I think probably more true of us, I think we tend to look back to our theological enemies as the cause of our decline. And so if you're evangelical, you tend to think that it was liberalism in the 19th and early 20th century that kind of sold the farm and ruined lots of things for lots of people. If you're Catholic, not only if you're Catholic, but you might be, you know, look at the Reformation and think like Gregory Boyd, this is an unintended consequence of the Reformation. Or if you're Pope Benedict or John Milbank, you even go back further to Dunce Scotus, who's like the real enemy. And so if you read Milbank or you read Pope Benedict, that those guys hate Dunce Scotus and kind of blame him for screwing up everything for everyone with nominism or whatever. Now, all of those things I think are relevant. So I think there were unintended consequences in the Reformation. I think the Enlightenment is a huge part of our mental furniture. I think Darwin's Origin of Species, and I think all those things are relevant. Even Dunce Scotus, if I understood what he meant, I might be concerned about what he said as well. But none of that top-down, people thought thoughts, and then eventually they found out that Christianity wasn't believable, and then having worked out it wasn't believable to stop going to church, that turns out to be not true, or at least not evidence-based. So it doesn't account, or at least doesn't sufficiently account, for the actual evidence that we have. The change that you and I are living through and in which we operate is much sharper and shorter and suddener, is that even a word? More sudden and more ground up than I think we think. Much less, not nothing to do with, but much less to do with the thoughts that people had, much more to do with changes in the culture that affected a whole pattern of work and ministry. So things change quickly. Do you, are you, go.
Was that 1963 decline due to different trading hours and the cinema being open?
So this is the smoking gun. So I'm going to keep doing the questions because I know that you guys can hear those. So question is, what's the 1963 situation? So discuss, but what was it? Give yourself a moment to think, what is it about that moment? I don't want to be crazy about 1963, so that early 1960s, something happened. I want to hold the tension because I've got stuff to say about it, but yeah. But yeah, so I mean, you think trading hours, the Beatles. I'm going to put the Beatles up now. So this is the thing I want to say. I think sometimes, I'm not saying that it was the Beatles, okay? The only point that the Beatles are up there is to illustrate how quickly things change in general. So, I think I used to think, in fact I once wrote an article that argued this, which I now disagree with, that there was a whole thing from the Bloomsbury Group that just kind of gently came down to the Beatles and... Do you know what I mean? This kind of, I think I once held that view, about the slow, gentle decline from the elites to the popular thing or whatever. But you know the Beatles, you think about the Beatles, they went from, I want to hold your hand, to, why don't we do it in the road? So, I think about that as their kind of, at least sexually, that's their, I want to hold your hand, so why don't we do it in the road? That they seem to be two different takes on relationships. So I thought that I Want to Hold Your Hand would have been early to mid-50s. You know, the kind of the bands with the suits and the straight and stuff like that. And I would have thought that Why Don't We Do It in the Road sounds to me like mid-70s. Sort of, it's like when Alice Cooper's biting heads off chickens and like it's this, you know, that feels like I Want to Hold Your Hand to Why Don't We Do It in the Road to me sound like very different times. But of course, Beatles are from 1963 to 1969. So they kind of just technically make it into the 1970s. But they do all that, release all those albums in this kind of 7-year period and go from Suits, I Want to Hold Your Hand to Why Don't We Do It in the Road and the White Album and, that happens really quickly. And, you know, that's about the distance from us from 2011 to now. So things can change quickly is my only point with the Beatles, although they are relevant to our specific, study. So we're trying to think, why is that the case? Why does that sudden precipitous decline happen in Christian things? Another complicating factor, all I'm trying to do now is to say that it's complicated. Another complicating factor is that if you try to think like sociologists, then sociologists the nature of the discipline is that you don't tend to think about beliefs except for how they influence culture. So you're not too interested in whether a belief is true or false or intellectually credible or what, right? And so we look at the world and say, oh man, the church is, that church is now a restaurant and this thing's declining and this thing's going down. Now sociologists will say, what is a church? And they're not looking for a theological answer, they're looking for a sociological answer. And a church is a voluntary community institution, or it's what they would call a mediating institution. So a church is not the state, and the state uses coercion. So the state eventually has a monopoly on violence. And so if you don't pay your taxes, eventually you'll get to the point where the state brings its monopoly on violence to the forefront and forcibly takes you to jail. Because that's how the state works ultimately by coercion, or at least it has a monopoly on coercion. And the market, which is profit, right? So the market says, hey, I'll do X if you do Y, and let's trade, and let's both be advantaged by this trade. Now, mediating institutions are neither coercive nor for profit. They exist in between those two things, and sociologists are very fond of mediating institutions because they're hugely important for cohesive societies. I recently got involved in lacrosse because my kids got involved in lacrosse. And has anyone here played lacrosse? Or we all had to Google it on our phones, like, what is this thing? Because the kids came home and like, oh, we're going to start doing lacrosse. And so we got involved in lacrosse by accident. And lacrosse, to me at least, it feels a lot like Christianity, because I thought, why does this suddenly feel so familiar? Because like, you get there and you show up to lacrosse and suddenly you're on the roster to do the oranges and the things, and suddenly you're brought into this thing and you're, hey, get involved, and then they want you to learn how to do this game, and they want you to love the game and learn the game. And in lacrosse, if you just said, hey, here's $200, I support your organisation, right? And you said, hey, I can subcontract the oranges, I can get someone else to do that for you, I really don't want to be there. The lacrosse doesn't think, oh great, we're only here to make money anyway, so that. It doesn't, lacrosse only wants you to be part, they want you to love the game. And, you know, your church and my church feel like that. Someone comes in and they're not Christian, we're like, hey, we want you to know this and love this. And if you look at all volunteer organisations since 1963, they all go south. So the state gets bigger and the market gets bigger, and those two balloons blow up and up and up, and mediating institutions get squeezed. And so one complicating factor is to ask the question, what happens to things that aren't for profit or aren't ultimately coercive? And something about our culture means they all get squeezed at the moment. So that's worth factoring in. Then the third thing, as we're trying to think scientifically, is that it's pan-national. So this is very important for diagnosis, that you've got to acknowledge that this trend happens in more than Australia. So it also happens in New Zealand, it also happens in Canada, it also happens in the UK. At about the same time, like 1963 is a relevant date in all those places, and it's out of step, of course, with most of the world, and out of step with the USA, which is important. But the relevance of the pan-national nature of that change is that you can't, here's the principle, you can't explain a particular, you can't explain a universal with a particular. So you can't, whatever happened in Australia, it is, you cannot explain it by something uniquely Australian if it also happened in those other places. So I'll give you an example. One of the things in the 70s and 80s in Australian church history, as people started to see this and think, oh man, something's going on, there was a huge narrative about saying that Christianity in Australia was failing because it had failed to indigenise. So you go in Australia, you see the churches, and they had Union Jacks on them or whatever, and they were reading like from kind of old prayer books or whatever, and it was all like, and so people said, so Gregory Dicker says, Christianity has remained a potted plant rather than taking root in Australian soil. So there was a huge movement in the 70s and 80s with Mal Garvin and John Smith and Bruce Brewer and others to develop a Christianity with an Australian accent. Is it people familiar with this, or does that sound, anyone remember these movements? Now, is that a worthwhile movement? Sure. Like, I think, yeah. I think lots of great stuff came out of that. That's a very good question. Have we failed to address the culture? Is it the explanation for what happened in the 60s? It can't be. That can't be the explanation, because it also happens in Canada, and it also happens in New Zealand, and it also happens in England. So you've got all these control experiments to say you have to exclude that as the primary explanation, because you can't explain a universal with a particular. Similarly with the thought that Australia is a particularly godless nation. So I think that's just not true historically, and also you can't explain a universal with a particular. Okay, so people are asking, how does this happen? And this is where we get to the secularisation thesis. So three main phases of the secularisation thesis. The whole of sociology was sort of born out of secularisation theory. It was kind of the birthplace of it. And so you had Weber, Durkheim, and Marx. You can just listen to this. Don't have to write anything down. So Weber says, oh, it's to do with a bureaucratic society, the rise of science, and which led to a disenchantment with the world, and then naturally a decline of religion. Emil Durkheim says that religion binds societies together and smaller face-to-face communities, but as societies urbanize, then you have individualization and then religion decline. So Weber says it's to do with rationality and science. Durkheim says it's to do with the breakdown of smaller communities that have religion. And then Karl Marx is the third kind of father of secularization thinking, and he says that religion is a kind of mediating thing between now and the secular state. His actual idea, Marx is much more sympathetic to religion than Marxism. So I'll give you this quote. This is Marx, and this is where the famous quote comes from, but listen to it in its context. Religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature, the heart of a heartless world, the soul of soulless condition. It is the opium of the people. It's kind of a beautiful sentence, isn't it? Religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature, the heart of a heartless world, the soul of soulless condition. So his take on it is not that it's the opium of the people, as in let's get rid of it ASAP. He says it's the necessary opiate for a broken world that will be perfected in the socialist utopia. Linda Woodhead says, ironically, the early sociologists were not sociological enough about themselves. That they failed to reflect on the fact that they were all Europeans who were all, enthusiastic about the European project and thought in terms of progress, that they all thought whatever else it is, things are progressing, and whether they're progressing this way or that way or this way, let's all agree that progress is what everything's about. And they all believed that Europe was, of course, at the cutting edge of all societies, and all societies would eventually follow Europe. Then phase two of secularisation thesis is from World War II to the 1970s, the classical period. This is where the idea that that secularisation is bound to modernity and is predictive, so that because European societies modernised and they secularised, therefore modernisation brings secularisation. And so Brian Wilson and Steve Bruce and others worked hard in this, and Peter Berger, who is the kind of transitional figure, because that theory that modernisation necessarily brings secularisation failed to be predictive in all sorts of ways. Can you think of any ways that, if you think about that basic thesis, in what ways might the facts have disrupted it? Yep.
Did South Korea, did they
rapidly
modernise, but they also rapidly Christianise?
Yeah, but, or did you break it open? Insert most non-Western European nations here. Yeah, so South Korea, Malaysia, Indonesia, a whole ton of places do modernise and don't secularise. In fact, opposite of the thesis, Indonesia and Malaysia are both more religious now than they were, and both more modern now than they were. And so it just seems like it's beautifully empirically disproved that it just is not the case. The other big one, of course, is the United States of America, which is always frustrating because you've got this big booming kind of situation of a place that is both ridiculously modern and ridiculously religious. And so the secularisation thesis kind of comes into trouble. And then some people start to say, well, maybe it's not happening at all. Maybe there's no such thing as secularisation, that it's that maybe you're defining religion too narrowly. So it's like saying, oh, let's look at the decline of telegrams. So telegrams were very popular in the 50s. 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000, suddenly no one's into telegrams anymore, therefore people aren't into communication. You think, oh, actually, there's also text messages, and actually, it's not true. So it could be the truth that to say that, okay, religion in terms of people going to the local state, you know, the local Church of England or the local Catholic Church has changed, but maybe that's not a sufficient definition of religion. Other people have said the idea that secularisation is happening is dependent on a mythical golden age where people were super into religion and church. And there's some empirical cases against this. Well, a really curious one is architecture. So, you know, you go around Europe and you look at all the churches and you think, oh, this at least used to be a very churchy situation. But if you do the maths on how many people could fit into the churches of Europe, there weren't enough, like by a long way. And so there's this kind of a little bit of evidence of like, even if that church was full every Sunday, it's not possible that most people were getting there. And then things like Rodney Stark argues that church membership in Britain was higher in the year 2000 than it was in the 1800s, in the year 1800, when only 12% belonged to a specific congregation. So there's some, I think that's really worth doing, to not think golden age us, but to see a whole lot of texture and a whole lot of up and down in Christian commitment that happens. I'm going to go, if I go 3 more minutes into lunch, is that all right? And then they'll just get up to the right spot. Sorry, no, that's bad. I need to ask you, would it be okay if I went a few more minutes?
Yeah.
Excellent. Is there any hot food or anything waiting for us? Cool. Okay, I want to get this stuff out, and then because we need to, like, this is where you guys take over afterwards to tell us what the solutions are, so we need to get there. Okay, account. As we've said, there's this top-down account that I think is the most popular one in people's heads. So the new atheists, and like most people, would say it's to do with the Enlightenment, scientific revolution, gave us all we need, we can get rid of religion. And I think the new atheist project is to say, it's really frustrating that we gave you science and you're still holding on to religion. And so it felt like you would just naturally get rid of it, but now it turns out you need to be pushed because you idiots, you missed the memo. And so they say that actually education will eventually wipe out religion, but it might need a bit of a nudge. But that turns out to be empirically just not true. So religion, especially evangelicalism, thrived in the Enlightenment. Like, that was its moment. Wesley and Whitfield and the evangelical revival was in the Enlightenment. That was when it was kind of modern evangelicalism was given birth. Secondly, if that's true, that it's just this, we just lost on points to science and rationality, why the sudden drop in the 60s? Was there suddenly, no one just, it's not that they suddenly gave Origin of Species to every kid in every school and every kid in every school read it and thought, oh man, we were wrong. The 60s is a weird moment to say that science won. It's not obvious that that's the case. Church attendance being so strong in the United States. And in the United States, in a way that I find troubling as a pastor, but true, it's true sociologically, the most predictive indicator, and this is also true in Australia, the most predictive indicator that you will go to church is that you're in the top third of the demographics. So the most educated go to church. And the least educated, and this has happened in the States, which has been a big change, increasingly don't go to church, the bottom third. And do you see how that's, I find that troubling because I feel like Jesus would prefer it the other way around. But in terms of the theory that Christians are dummies that held on to a dumb thing, you would expect it to be the opposite. But of course, then all the uneducated will still go to church, and eventually when they get educated, and the exact opposite thing is true. So it can't be that. And then of course you have, again, you have huge religious revivals, kind of peak evangelicalism is in the Victorian era around the Origin of Species. Like that was kind of a great time for evangelical Christianity and for a very religious, England, which was not so religious in the late 1800s. So that's a weird point to get a boom when you'd expect a bust. You know, Marx says people will stop needing the comforts of religion, but as lots of people point out, religion's not that comforting. Like, compared to exclusive humanism, the thought that there's a God that will hold you to account, final judgment, and an incredibly difficult moral code. Like, Christianity sexual ethics is kind of off the charts for how difficult it is. Anyway, not so comforting. And then you have the, Milbank and Benedict and so on. Tom Frame, I feel like, kind of lands here in a way that I find kind of curious. I really like his writing and what he does, but he has this kind of top-down approach to unbelief in Australia that, it's the end of, it's the weariness from sectarianism, the church out of touch with the latest scientific thinking and unable to speak with a clear, united voice and so on. And again, I found that an odd thing of an otherwise really helpful book. Then the bottom-up things, and then we're done. Peter Hitchens and Roy Williams, another Australian author, says it's the war, that the church disgraced itself in the two world wars by being involved in, by not speaking prophetically into those situations. And we may agree, maybe you think the church should have been more prophetic in that situation, but I don't think it could be the cause of the decline, because why the 60s? Like, why does it take 15 years to suddenly think, oh, we shouldn't have done that a generation ago? It's an odd moment. It's odd to have a religious boom after the Second World War, if the war was the thing that caused religious decline. And what about places like England is in the 60s, but Ireland becomes secular, like now, it's happening live, you can go and film it. And a place like Switzerland is very secular and was neutral in the war. Again, materialism surely is a part of this, but secularism, again, the US being the exception and that top third getting to church and all that kind of thing. And the church's failings, the church had failings? Oh my goodness. But sociologically, they don't seem to be indexed against the decline. Do you know what I mean? So in the 60s, people were not saying the Royal Commissions and stuff weren't things that led to the decline. So I'm going to tell you exactly what did cause it after lunch.